지속적으로 가중되고 있는 미국의 대조선 적대시 정책과 분별 없는 핵위협은 천만 국민의 단합된 철의 의지와 서영화, 경량화, 다정화된
Welcome to the simultaneous translation in Korean of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And filling in for Ken Rudin, I'm Julie Rovner.
Welcome to the podcast, Julie.
Thank you very much.
It's a great pleasure to have you here with us. And let me just say that if you think things were kind of wacky in Pyongyang this past week, you should have been in the United States Capitol.
Yes, where it was ridiculously cold for April.
Yes, indeed it was. And there were so few people up on Capitol Hill, other than reporters looking for members of Congress who were all on recess, that they all had to go down to the White House and cover some of the really major news-making events that were going on there.
You mean like the Easter egg roll?
Hi. Is everybody ready? Is everybody ready? You ready with your spoon? Go!
And the shooting of free throws.
This the one right here. There you go. Oh.
I think that the president probably was glad that he filled out a bracket in the NCAA tournament and wasn't playing in it.
That's probably right, too. The president has actually had pretty good luck putting up three-pointers and things like that on the campaign trail. But now that he's not running for office, apparently some of that magic has deserted him. The president does have something for Congress next week, though. His budget.
That's right, and it's only 2 months late. I guess the budget was due in February, and we're having February weather to go along with it.
That's a good explanation. The Congress, of course, will take the president's budget and carefully study it and take its cues from the president's budget with respect to taxes and spending for all the programs and carefully consider this in hearings and decide whether or not the president's budget is the plan they want to follow.
No.
Not again this year?
Not again this year.
Well, what does Congress do instead?
Well, what Congress is supposed to do is the House passes its budget resolution, the Senate passes its budget resolution. They're supposed to do that by April 15th. Now, remarkably, the House and Senate have actually done that before.
And that's gotten to be unusual.
Yes, this is highly unusual. In fact, people couldn't remember the last time they got it done in time for the April 15th deadline. This year, there was a little bit of, shall we call it, incentive for them to get it done. And that's because if they didn't, they were going to actually have to take a pay cut.
And close down the government.
And close down the government. Well, they didn't have to do the budget resolution in order to close down the government. They had to do that
continuing
resolution. That's right.
For the actual appropriations that actually do spend money.
That's right. That part is for real. The budget resolution is just this sort of fancy, what do we think we might want next year's budget to look like?
So it's a proposal for a plan.
That's right. It's a proposal for a plan.
And it isn't really a plan, let alone a budget.
And nor does it, in fact, go to the president. But what's supposed to happen now is that they're supposed to get together, the House and the Senate, the leaders of the budget committees, and they're supposed to put together one budget resolution that reflects the priorities of both the House and the Senate. And the number of people who think that's actually going to happen is about equivalent to the number of basketball shots that the president made at the Easter egg roll, which for those people who were not paying attention was, I believe, two.
Two out of 22. All
yes.
Right. Well, just to be clear, there have been times back in the 1980s and here and there when the Congress has really paid attention to the president's proposal for a plan that he calls his budget. We just haven't really been there for quite some time.
That's right. Congress normally does not. It is a courtesy that now Congress says, thank you for sending us a budget, and now we're going to go off and do our own, although recently Congress hasn't even bothered to do its own.
And in the end, the real spending decisions essentially get made in terms of the appropriations bills, and in the absence of actual appropriations bills signed by the president, we get these continuing resolutions that just continue the previous year's appropriations decisions into the new year. And also, the president spent some time talking about a project that would map the human brain, spend $100 million. Here's what he had to say.
And of course, none of this will be easy. If it was, we'd already know everything there was about how the brain works, and presumably my life would be simpler here. It would could explain all kinds of things that go on in Washington. And we could prescribe something. So it won't be easy. But think about what we could do once we do crack this code.
What code is he talking about here, Julie?
Well, you know, some years ago, I believe it was George W. Bush who suggested that we go ahead and map the human genome, which was a big effort on the part of the National Institutes of Health. This is a somewhat smaller effort to map the human brain. But, you know, this is something...
You mean smaller in terms of the dollar amount.
Yes, smaller in terms of the dollar amount. But this is something the presidents like to do when they set out their own budget. Congress always ignores the budget as a whole, but presidents do get to put in the budget, you know, some of these little discrete proposals. And occasionally those proposals do get picked up by Congress, and they like to, you know, in advance of the budget, say, this is one of the things that I'm going to put forward in my budget next week, something that you might like. You might hate the budget, but you might like this proposal. So this was one of those, and they get to have, you know, a nice press conference at the White House.
Well, and some decades ago, as I understand it, one of those little ideas that got funded in the budget led to the research that led eventually to the creation of the Internet, or at least that's what I read on the Internet. Now, while Congress does not seem to be terribly interested in the president's proposal for a plan with respect to taxes and spending, they are taking up a number of other pieces of legislation in the weeks ahead that are responsive to the president's, let us say, priorities, in particularly with respect to social issues, or if you will, cultural issues, societal issues, guns, immigration, same-sex marriage. Well, same-sex marriage isn't really legislation, but it's on everybody's mind because of the court cases. And there, the president's priorities seem to be, to some degree, shared by the leadership, at least in the Senate, and to some degree, the House is being responsive as well.
That's right. And, of course, next week, although not quite as early as we thought in the week, but next week it looks like the Senate's going to take up gun legislation. Of course, it may get filibustered, and it probably will not. Well, we know it will not have an assault weapon ban, but we think it will probably, at least going to the floor, have a background check provision in it. And the Senate, there's still some scrambling to try and find at least five Republicans to prevent a successful filibuster. But certainly it's not as aggressive legislation as the president had hoped back in January when, coming off, I guess, the shock of what happened in Connecticut, the public was certainly seemed to be in favor of.
That's right. And the president, of course, was responding to what happened in Connecticut as well. He's traveling to Connecticut next week for an event in Hartford. This past week, he went to Colorado, essentially in a nod to Aurora and also, of course, back all the way to Columbine. And also in recognition of the state laws that have been adopted in those two states, Colorado and Connecticut, that are much more restrictive than what appears to be possible on the federal level. And at the federal level, because a lot of those states that are not passing new restrictive gun laws have representation here in Washington, and also because so many members fear what could happen to them in 2014 if they have the active opposition of gun owners, well organized by the NRA and other organizations like Gun Owners of America, that are really quite insistent that there be no change whatsoever in gun laws. And they started a task force in response to Newtown in Connecticut, and the task force came forth with the NRA's recommendation for how to keep kids safer in schools, and it was presented this week by former member of Congress Asa Hutchinson.
If you have the firearm on the presence of someone in the school that can reduce the response time, it will save lives. That is the objective. Now, one of the key elements is weapon retention. Firearm retention and how they know how to protect that and to make sure it's properly cared for during the course of the normal school day. That is a key element of the training, model training program that is being presented.
So I guess weapon retention means where they keep the gun, doesn't it? I mean, either they carry it around on themselves while they're teaching or while they're walking the halls, or do they keep it somewhere in a locked cabinet? I guess that's what the retention issue is.
You know, what's really stunning in looking at all of this is that when Wayne LaPierre from the NRA talked about this, you know, right in the heat of everything after Newtown, everybody was so, you know, what do you mean we're going to put an armed guard in every school? And they thought that this was absolutely the most absurd thing they'd ever thought. And now it's, what, 3 months later. And, you know, if you look at the polls, sort of the urgency of this issue really has waned. It's really sort of the idea of you know, short attention span public. And I remember when Congress was trying to pass, you know, the crime bill, which, you know, the last big crime bill in 1993. And that resulted in the Republican takeover, basically,
the legislation,
yeah,
where they banned assault weapons.
That's right.
For 10 years. That really hurt a lot of Democrats that
yeah.
year.
I mean, just muscling that through was quite the effort. It's hard to know whether they're going to be able to do something, even something much, much, much less this time.
It could even be argued that some of these states passing these tougher laws is going to hurt the case for passing tougher laws at the federal level, because the opponents will just say, well, fine, let the states all go do what they want to do, and the states that want to restrict Second Amendment rights can do so, and the states that want to defend Second Amendment rights should be allowed to do so, and the federal government should stay out of it. I think we'll hear a lot of that argument in the next several weeks. But if they're threatening to filibuster anything that restricts guns in any way in the Senate, we don't hear the same kind of filibuster threats on the immigration issue.
Yeah, interestingly enough, although I think, you know, this is part of the big Republican reboot. If Republicans want to do better, that they're going to have to look at the changing demographics of the country. And part of the big changing demographics is a much larger Latino population. And immigration is going to have to be a big piece of that. So I think the Republicans see that they've got to do better on that issue. And I think they're sort of, if not all in, at least more in on that one.
Well, and you've got this gang of eight in the Senate, of course, which includes Marco Rubio from Florida, and both of the Republican senators from Arizona, and Lindsey Graham from South Carolina. These are people with pretty good cred among at least mainstream conservatives, and they're willing to talk about even a path to citizenship, which would, of course, bring the Democrats on board more or less. And then in the House, they've got their own bill.
There does seem to be movement, more movement on immigration than there has been, you know, perhaps since 1986, the last time they did a really major immigration bill. Whether this comes to fruition, I'm still not holding my breath. You know, they announced over the weekend last week that they had gotten a deal, and then immediately after they announced they got a deal, there were people saying, wait, not so fast.
But it seems as though every moment that the thing seems to stall again because of, you know, some sticky issue such as guest workers or what have you, some incident comes along that embarrasses the Republican Party again, and they want to come back out and say, no, no, we really do want to be more open to Hispanics, more friendly to Hispanics, including Hispanic voters. And this time, the incident was provided by Congressman Don Young of Alaska.
My father had a ranch. We used to hire 50 to 60 wetbacks and to pick tomatoes. You know, it takes two people to pick the same tomatoes now. That's all done by machine.
The congressman is referring to growing up in Central California some decades ago. And yes, that is a term that many people used at the time. The congressman certainly is aware that that was derogatory then, and it's derogatory now. But when he was talking to his local radio station there in Alaska, apparently felt that nobody would mind. Here in the age of the internet, your local radio station is essentially a microphone to the world.
He did apologize, but again, you know, these things keep happening, and they keep happening, and they keep happening. And, you know, every time the Republican Party tries to say, really, we're better on this, somebody, then you have another event like this.
The Republican Party is also struggling with the same-sex marriage issue. One more social issue that is getting an awful lot of media attention, getting an awful lot of attention from the courts at this particular time, and some of the states have been changing their laws as well. This week, two Democrats, Senator Tom Carper of Delaware and Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania, came out saying that they were ready to change their votes on gay marriage. Now, it's not before the Senate in any meaningful way, but it's interesting that we now have 48 Democrats in the Senate, 48 Democrats and independents who side with the Democrats, who are willing to say they're for gay marriage, and we're down to only seven who have not said so. And over on the Republican side, something of a defining partisan issue here, there are only two senators who are Republicans who are willing to say they're for gay marriage. Of course, earlier we heard Rob Portman from Ohio be the first one, and this week Mark Kirk from Illinois joined him, and he released a statement saying he would endorse same-sex marriage. The other 43 Republicans still oppose gay marriage.
Although there's starting to be hints about some, but we're still waiting.
Here's the question: will the Republicans get to 5 in favor before the Democrats get to 50?
Yes, actually, I think the Republicans will get to 5 before the Democrats get to 50. But that's only because the 7 who are remaining are probably going to remain for some time. At least that's the theory, that the 7 who remain are from pretty conservative states and will probably keep their own counsel, as they say. Since, as you point out, this is not before the Senate; it's before the Supreme Court.
That's not something
they're going to have to vote on any time in the near future.
That's right. But members of both the Senate and the House like to unburden themselves of their opinions on these salient issues of the day. And one of those states you mentioned that's a little more conservative is the state of Texas, where Congressman Louie Gohmert likes to share some of his opinions frequently, actually, on the floor. And you can see him on C-SPAN. Here's a little bit of what he had to say about gay marriage.
It's kind of like marriage. When you say it's not a man and a woman anymore, then why not have three men and one woman, or four women and one man, and or why not, you know, if somebody has a love for an animal? There is no clear place to draw the line once you eliminate the traditional marriage, and it's the same.
I think it might be worth pointing out that he was actually talking about guns there. So, you know,
this was a parenthesis in the midst of a discussion of how big a magazine you should have on your gun.
That's right. And so, you know, this is the new Republican message. And all I can say is I'm really glad I'm not Reince Priebus right now.
You mean the chairman of the Republican National Committee, who's trying to get the party to sort of talk about other things and not talk about this particular issue so much?
Well, not talk about a lot of these, you know, sort of thorny social issues right now. If this is part of the reboot of the Republican Party, I think they keep putting their reboot in their mouth.
All right. Good point. Well put. One of the issues that they do seem to be making some headway on, though, in terms of changing the law in the states, the Republican side, is the pro-life issue, where we've seen North Dakota and some other states passing tougher laws restricting abortion. And we've also seen states restricting the availability of abortion through Obamacare. Why is that issue moving in an opposite direction from some of the other social issues?
You know, there's a lot of discussion, particularly about the difference, what's going on between this vis-a-vis, you know, same-sex marriage. That there is so much movement in favor of same-sex marriage, and yet abortion is as contentious as ever, and there's, if anything, more movement sort of in the direction of more restrictions on abortion. And it is actually kind of hard to explain. One thing, of course, we know is that there are many more Republican state legislatures. That was sort of left over from the 2010 census, the redrawing of the lines.
And the 2010 election.
Well, yes, the 2010 election, which led to the census, which led to the redistricting, which led to a lot of these Republican legislatures, and which has led in turn to a lot of very restrictive abortion laws. We just saw some of the most restrictive abortion laws ever, both in Arkansas and in North Dakota. These will obviously be contested in court because they clearly conflict with Roe v. Wade. We will see if the Supreme Court agrees, obviously, but whether you can actually restrict abortions in some cases as soon as a fetal heartbeat is detected, that is something that is not currently allowed under the current configuration of Roe v. Wade. There's going to be another personhood amendment on ballot in North Dakota, which has been defeated twice, including in the very conservative state of Mississippi, which say that basically would make illegal all abortions and probably most forms of birth control. Life begins at conception. Life begins at fertilization. So really, even before the implantation of a fertilized egg. So that would put into question things like
birth control pills?
Not just birth control, but in vitro fertilization. So there are all kinds of questions about those, which is why it went down in Mississippi. So that's been defeated twice in Colorado, once in Mississippi. Now it's going to be on the ballot in North Dakota. So there's a lot going on, again, with these many very conservative state legislatures.
And there's a counter trend here, really, in terms of public opinion, because Republicans are seeing this upswelling of opinion change on guns, on immigration, particularly because of the election results in 2012, and of course also with same-sex marriage, where we've seen public opinion polls change quite rapidly. To some degree, some of that same trend visible in marijuana legalization, but not with abortion. With abortion, it appears that the public sentiment is not moving in the direction of greater liberal regulation, but rather more conservative regulation. And that could be a problem for the Republicans in certain situations where, if the laws become more restrictive, it becomes an issue on which women become more active.
And yet last year, I mean, we did see in those few cases where Republicans really overstepped on the abortion issue that they went down.
You're talking about Todd Akin or Richard Murdoch.
Talking particularly about Todd Akin and Richard Murdoch. I mean, that, you know, issues around rape were, you know, clearly went down. Women feel very strongly about birth control. The public's always had a very muddled view when it comes to abortion. They are basically of two minds. They believe that abortion is bad, but they also believe that it should be up to a woman to decide. And that's really the issue. They also believe that sort of the earlier in pregnancy it is, the more acceptable abortion is, the later in pregnancy, the less acceptable. So the abortion issue is multi-layered and very complicated.
Always been a tough one to poll, for certain. Now, Ken would never forgive us if we left today without mentioning the one result we got from actual voting in this week, and that was the runoff election in the 1st Congressional District of South Carolina. The name that makes this magic, of course, is Mark Sanford.
Mark Sanford, the, I guess, notorious former governor who wandered off to, or said he was wandering off to, hike the Appalachian Trail when we all now know he was off in Argentina canoodling with his then-girlfriend, now-fiancé.
Now-fiancé, who appeared on Tuesday night after the runoff vote had been partially counted, and it was clear Mark Sanford was winning the runoff over Curtis Bostic, his closest opponent in the original vote. I believe that in the end, Mark Sanford got better than 55% of the vote. It was an easy win. On the other hand, you'd have to say there's still a lot of Republicans who would rather have somebody else running for their party than Mark Sanford, and that some of those people might not show up when we have the final test in another 5 weeks or so in May, when he faces Elizabeth Colbert Bush.
Who is the sister of, I guess, South Carolina's most famous non-politician politician.
Stephen Colbert, who apparently invented that pronunciation of Colbert in his nom de plume, or pronunciation de plume, as an entertainer. So what do we know about Elizabeth Colbert Bush on her own, I mean, in her own right?
Well, that she's going to get a lot of money from her brother, and that's actually not insignificant. Clearly, it's a Republican district, but she's got name recognition.
Well, and there's the question, of course, as we were mentioning, the fiancé did show up at the celebration on Tuesday night. It was perhaps the first live picture of her a lot of people had had. She's a very appealing person. But there could be a resentment factor there. And the question is, will cultural conservatives in South Carolina be offended to some degree by this flaunting, if you will? And will there be women who will be offended by this? And would they, rather than perhaps vote for the Democrat in the district, stay home? Let the Democrat win now and maybe come back in 2014 if there's another Republican nominated against her then.
This is certainly going to be a fun race to watch.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Julie Rovner. Ken Rudin's back next week. The podcast is produced by Brecton Booker and edited by Kathy Shaw.
Thank you, Julie. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Join us again next week, won't you, for It's All Politics from NPR.
Alone up there, I'm on the trail and searching for love. Somehow, somewhere, I'll find what I'm dreaming of. I'll never fail. I'll find my love and it will be true. I'm on the trail. Do you remember?